Welcome to the St. Andrew Sunday Morning Sermon Podcast. You can connect with us online at www.gostandrew.com.
Genesis 1, 24 through 27. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures of every kind, cattle and creeping things, and wild animals of the earth of every kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals of the earth of every kind, and the cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground of every kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth."
As we enter into the second week of our House Divided series, we are continuing the conversation about how our faith applies to some of the most urgent issues of our day, issues that are maybe so contentious and emotional that we might think that they are entirely inappropriate to be talking about in a place like church. People get a little nervous when we mix politics and religion. It's been said that mixing politics and religion is like mixing ice cream with manure. It doesn't do much for the manure, but it really ruins the ice cream, right? And I don't want to ruin your ice cream this morning or for these next 7 weeks. Let's put aside, once again, partisan politics. Let's put aside all the sound bites, the talking points, the caricatures that define so much of our national debate and conversation. When we do Christian ethics, which is what we're doing here over these 7 weeks, we are applying ultimate meaning to proximate concerns. We are applying our scripture, our years, centuries of Christian tradition, our own personal and collective experience of faith, applying all of these things to the issues that are so desperately in front of us and needed to be resolved right now. Some of these issues are climate change. Last week, immigration. Next week will be gun violence. Today, we're talking about racism. We've entitled this series, "A House Divided," but maybe by the time it's all said and done, you might be calling it "Reverend Mark Bought the Big One." I don't know. I'm walking the tightrope. And once again, I want to invite you to dare to walk with me with humility. We're talking about race, the issue of race in America. And I want to acknowledge right at the gate, out of the gate, that here I am, the irony of it all, that I am a white male in a relatively affluent background, preaching right now in South Denver metro suburb in front of a congregation that is mostly white, mostly affluent, living in the same place. There is some absurdity to that. In fact, I thought earlier this year, as I was planning the series, that I'd bring in somebody who might have some more experience with racism. And then I thought, this is an opportunity to model a conversation that we can maybe go forward together and have these conversations in the world. What can I possibly speak about when it comes to race from my own limited vantage point? And what wisdom can I impart this morning that's not going to sound naive, paternalistic, or reductionist? I spent a lot of hours on this sermon in particular this week, and I want to share with you a little bit about what I have learned. And I want to do so by framing our conversation with two specific stories, both of which are true. Story number one, about a colleague of mine who happened to be in a major city at a conference in a high-rise building. The conference went late. She stayed even later, hanging out with some friends. At the end of the night, it was well past midnight, she went downstairs, went to this unlit parking lot to go find her car, mostly empty lot. And there, as she was walking to her car, she saw an older model truck prowling through the lot, maybe in her general direction. And she rushed to her car, she got in, she locked the doors, and she went to turn the ignition, and of course, it wouldn't start. As she watched more, the truck came closer and closer. She began to fumble for her AAA card, trouble finding her phone, at which point the truck came right in front of her car and stopped. And that's when her heart began to race, pound. And out of the truck emerged a tall black man carrying what appeared to be a thick rope. This is the point where she began to really panic. Just as she was putting in the numbers on her phone, 911, this man thumped on her windshield and said, "Lady, I'm maintenance. I noticed earlier that you left your lights on." Holding up his jumper cables, he said, "Just pop the hood and I'll get it started." And she said, in that moment, she felt her fear turn to relief, and then her relief turned to guilt. And what did her particular reaction to that situation speak about her own unspoken biases and beliefs? Story number two, Dr. Kamau Bob, B-O-B-B. Kamau Bob, he serves on the faculty at Georgia Tech. He also holds a global leadership position with Google. He was crawling along in traffic, rush hour traffic, just before dusk, coming home from work, when all at once he saw the red and blue lights suddenly flash behind him. He pulled his car over, and so too did the patrol officer pull his car over. And this, said Bob, is the singular moment in American life where black men wish they were white women. This is the moment that drives fear into the hearts of black people. Anything and any interaction with police can escalate to deadly outcomes, and there was no telling how this might go. As the approaching officer approached the back fender, he put his hand on his gun, and that's when Bob felt fear. He rolled down his window, at which point the officer commanded him to keep both hands on the wheel. He reached for his wallet, again the command, "Keep both hands on the wheel." And Bob said, "For white people who typically think that if you've done nothing wrong, everything will be fine, this is the moment they don't understand. This is the terror moment, the moment of anxiety at fever pitch." Another patrol car arrived. That officer came over, had a more cordial conversation. The situation de-escalated, and that was that. But what do you do with all that fear and all that humiliation? Where does it go? Throughout this series, I'm proposing axioms by which we can maybe find some common ground and mutual understanding on some of these issues. What's an axiom? It's a statement that is held to be common and true and without controversy or debate. Something like the sun rises in the east. Something like human beings have just one heart. Maybe heck is where you go when you don't believe in gosh. I'm just checking to see if you're listening. I'll give you a moment if you want to think about that. Here's axiom number one. How we think and talk about racism is largely determined by our own particular race. For my friend stranded in that unlit parking lot, fearing the black man who ultimately came to her assistance, her response suggested some unconscious bias that's based on skin color and stereotype. And for her and for many white people, racism is commonly understood as prejudicial attitudes or behaviors that are grounded specifically in beliefs related to skin color, related to human traits and human capacities. So my friend, who is a pastor, a good person, for her the term racist would be seemingly entirely inappropriate. And yet that sudden awareness of her unconscious bias led to this profound and humbling sense of guilt. But for Kamau Bob, ordered to keep both hands on the wheel during a routine traffic stop, racism for him is more than just individual prejudices or behaviors. For him, racism is experienced systemically, in the common and everyday structures of American life. It is the structures that seem to make life for Black people both unfair and unsafe. And that chronic sense of unfairness and the lack of safety leads to humiliation and fear. How we talk about race largely is determined by our own particular race, by the color of our skin and the experience that's lived in that skin. This is evident, actually, in our congregational survey. With about 600 respondents, we see that 83% of us who responded to the surveys believe that prejudice is largely an issue of individual attitudes and behaviors. Now, what I'll propose to you is if that same question was posed in a Black church, those numbers would be entirely reversed. The 4th-century theologian Thomas Aquinas put it this way: whatever is received according to the manner of the receiver. This means, of course, that we receive things not as they are, but as we are. If this doesn't make any sense, just imagine what it's like to try to communicate to a foreigner who's on tour here who doesn't speak your language. His or her capacity is only to understand what you're saying is determined, of course, by his own experience with that language. Think of it this way. If you had a conversation with your golden retriever, it would be very limited. It's even harder to have a conversation with your 15-year-old teenage boy, right? It means that whatever we communicate to another person can only be received by the person insofar as he has the capacity to understand it. What does this mean? It means that if we really want to understand race in America, as uncomfortable as it will be for many of us, we have the moral responsibility to open our eyes, to see what we don't see very often. We have the responsibility to open our minds, to try to understand a little bit more about what it's like to be Black in America. And Jesus said that if you go where I go and you follow me and you live out my word, that you'll know the truth and the truth will set you free. Courage. Do we have the courage to get into what it might be like to be Black in America today? Here's some truth that many of us may not know. If you're Black in America, you are 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than a white person. If you're Black and 18, you are more likely to go to prison than to college. Only 5.5% of Black men go to college, while 1 in 3 will go to prison within their lifetimes. The poverty rate for Black children is 38%. It's the highest rate of any ethnic or racial group in America. If you are Black in America, you are 6 times more likely to be incarcerated than a white person. You are more likely by a factor of 3 to be a victim of robbery. You're 5 times more likely to be victims of a homicide. And you are 10 times more likely to have a parent in jail. Now, all of this begs the question, are these statistics a consequence of something that's more systemic than simply individual prejudice? The late writer David Foster Wallace, he told a story about these two fish, young fish, who are swimming along when they happen to meet this older fish that's swimming the other way. And the older fish nods and says to them, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, only then one finally looks over at the other and says, "What the heck is water?" Beyond our individual, often unconscious biases, is there something in the water? Is there something invisible in the water that all of us are swimming in, but that some of us don't quite see? Which leads to axiom number two, gleaned from the words of the black writer Ta-Nehisi Coates. I commend his work to you. Race is the child of racism, not the father. Race is the child of racism, not the father. Now, history proves that the exploitation of black persons came first, and only then did we develop an ideology to support it, an ideology of unequal races. To make slavery work at all, we had to create an ideology of exploitation based on categories of unequal race. This is not only historically true, but it is biblically true. And you heard the story read this morning, the story about how it all began, the creation story. Earth was a soup of nothingness, a bottomless emptiness, an inky blackness. And God's Spirit brooded over it like a bird above the abyss. And then God's Spirit and breath gave birth first to light, sky, land, plants, trees, stars, bugs, gnats, and ultimately God's greatest idea, human beings. The word is Adam, Adam. And before it became a proper name for a particular person, Adam was a general term that spoke of humankind. And God says, let us make human beings in our image and make them reflecting our nature. In our image, reflecting our nature, it is doctrine of Imago Dei, which expresses the sense of an inherent worth and dignity of equal value of all people. This doctrine in this text, it doesn't support any notion whatsoever of separate races. It has no understanding of skin color as a factor in capacities and human traits. People may have different skin color, but they belong to the same human race, descended from the same parentage, Adam and then Eve. And these humans all reflect the same image of God, morally, rationally, intellectually, spiritually, bodily. So that any notion of white supremacy is just not only illogical, but it's completely unbiblical. The idea of race is a fiction. It's a social construct that is birthed by a sinful ideology of supremacy. Race is the child of racism, not the father. And I think when we understand this, we can begin to understand that racism is more than simply prejudice based on skin color, but as an ideology that has embedded itself in systems that have endured for almost exactly 400 years in our country. If you're with me, one more axiom. Axiom number three, my final one. And this will surprise you, and it will sound contradictory to my last one, but bear with me. Colorblindness is a myth that blinds us to the truth. Colorblindness is a myth that blinds us to the truth. I don't know about you. I grew up in the 1970s and 80s in a suburb, middle-class suburb of Southern California, about 50 miles outside of Los Angeles. In that time and in that place, it would have been completely unacceptable to ever utter a racial slur or any racial comment whatsoever. We lived in this time that we thought was a post-racial society. I grew up watching shows like Soul Train on Saturday morning, right? White Shadow, What's Happening? For me, skin color was not an issue. All were the same. And I bought this cultural narrative that also said we're all equal. We grew up singing red and yellow, black and white. All are precious in God's sight. Meanwhile, our parents were holding hands, singing, We Shall Overcome. And it was all based on this idea that color blindness was the key to eradicating racism. And in part, that came from the great dream of Martin Luther King Jr., who dreamed of a world in which we would judge one another not by the color of our skin, but by the content of our character. It seemed as if the civil rights movement had reached its ultimate conclusion. And yet, it never occurred to me in middle school, in high school, that my middle-class suburban town had very few black people. And I believed with all of my heart that we were all the same, and yet it didn't occur to me that if that were true, wouldn't that mean that we'd all be living pretty much in the same place? It wasn't until much later in my life that I began to understand why, in part. And I want to suggest that it might go back at least to June 22nd, 1944, when the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, also commonly known as the GI Bill of Rights, was signed into law. The GI Bill was passed to infuse massive capital into the lives of our returning World War II heroes and veterans, to give them a place where they could re-enter society, they could get a head start. And so that program, as we know, led to benefits like low-interest mortgages, like zero-down payment loans, like educational benefits. This would provide all of these heroes that came back from war with incredible challenges in front of them. It would provide for them a way to carve out a stable future. One important provision of that GI Bill was, of course, low interest and zero down payment loans for servicemen, with more favorable terms, of course, on loans for new construction. Millions of Americans, including both of my parents' families, my grandfathers, both were veterans. Millions of American families moved out of the urban centers and began building homes in the suburbs. And so began the suburbanization of America and the flight from urban centers. What I suggest and what's proven is that not everybody went with us. Because the GI Bill was managed and directed by local, mostly white officials, many of our black veteran heroes did not benefit like our white heroes did. Banks and mortgages refused often on a regular basis, refused loans to black veterans. And as millions of veterans applied to go to college, it's proven now that only 1/5 of all blacks who applied for college were admitted. As the American suburbs flourished, our urban centers floundered. School funding was immediately then attached to property taxes, which took the economic carpet right out from underneath our inner city public school systems. Banks stopped giving loans to businesses in urban centers as high-risk investments, a policy known as redlining. Many main streets were simply shuttered. And eventually our inner cities finally collapsed after this tragic game of social Jenga played itself out. For the black community, we shall overcome felt like we've been overcome. And meanwhile, we were all told that we had made great progress on race relations, that we were all the same, that we could all get along. It just wasn't true. And we hear the prophet Jeremiah, centuries ago, who cries out, "They have treated the wound of my people carelessly, saying, 'Peace, peace,' when there is no peace." I want you to imagine training for a marathon, months and months of training and preparation, only to discover on race day that not all the runners get to start the race at the same place, that some actually start at the 5-mile mark or maybe even the 10-mile mark, and you show up and the gun goes off and you're already losing. And the race director says, but if you just work a little harder, if you train a little more, you might make it with the rest. If you're like me, all of this strikes a very tender nerve. Some call it white fragility. This sense of deep guilt and denial. And my intention is not at all to make you feel bad about being white. Don't get me wrong. I can't speak for you. All I can say is what's true for myself, that I can do nothing about my unconscious and unspoken biases unless I know my history. And my well-intentioned colorblindness keeps me blind to the truth. In the words of the great William Faulkner, the past isn't dead. It's not even past. So what can we do? In the words of Dr. King, where do we go from here? Three quick suggestions. Number one, listen to people. Listen to people who are willing to share. White people, black people. Become a history, a student of history and a student of place. Do you know the history of Denver? Do you know the stories and the wounds, the collective wounds of people? Listen to people who are willing to share. Number two, talk about what you learn with others, which is exactly what I'm trying to do here today. You don't have to be an expert. You just have to be honest and a little courageous. And number three, where there is relationship, enter in more deeply as the other will allow. Because in the end, the solution to the issue of race in our country is not by thinking better. It's by loving better.
Our mission at St. Andrew United Methodist Church is to inspire spiritual maturity in outwardly focused Christians who love their neighbors and serve the common good. St. Andrew is a reconciling congregation of the United Methodist Church, welcoming all people and families of all kinds. You can connect with us online at www.gosaintandrew.com.